This feature of the Science News Radio Network is coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas. Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
And as always, it's so good to have you back again as we explore the exciting world of the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. Remind those of you listening on radio, you can also hear us commercial-free online and webcast at promiseoftomorrow.biz. A very exciting show today. We've got a remarkable man I want to introduce you to, Donald V. Watkins. Now, you know, you've heard of a lot of really successful black attorneys. I mean, they come to mind really easy. Verdon Jordan, you know, Andrew Young, Thurgood Marshall, just on and on and on the list is. But you're going to get to meet Donald Watkins today. Donald Watkins had a modest beginning as a child in the 50s during the civil rights movement in Montgomery, Alabama. His family knew Rosa Parks. Martin Luther King was a Sunday school teacher, and he rose because he is, first of all, a brilliant man, and had a lot of support from people that believed in him. He gives a lot of credit to other people. And he became a very wealthy businessman and an extremely successful lawyer. You're going to hear all about it. It's going to be a fun show. Watkins is the brilliant mind behind what guided Alabama State University team up with Total Protection Services Global to create the Nuclear Protection Academy this last September. And that's what we're mainly interested in because, of course, you've heard the CEO of Total Protection Services Global, Francina Hulris, has been on this program in the past. She's going to be back again, too, because she's a fascinating woman. And that team of getting the Nuclear Protection Academy at Alabama State University is going to train people that are going to protect us at our nuclear facilities and our other energy facilities. As a matter of fact, by the way, Francina is speaking at the 6th Annual Green Technology Conference going on in Corpus Christi, Texas, the 3rd and 4th of April. You might want to get down there and visit with her. She is going to be doing an extremely insightful talk titled Green Vulnerabilities and Avoiding Disaster. And I can't wait to hear what she has to say about that. Green Vulnerabilities and Avoiding Disaster. And that's going to be by Francina Hulris, who is the CEO and President of Total Protection Services Global, who right now is guarding some of our vital nuclear power plants around the country. So, a lot of exciting things going on. We're going to visit the Den of Strangers, get more wisdom from somebody a lot of us never heard of, visit our Fountain of Useless Information we keep here on the set, and of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. But right now, let's get to our guest. Well, when we think of the successful attorneys in the United States that have been very, very successful and of African-American descent, names like Verdon Jordan, Andrew Young, Thurgood Marshall, I mean, the list is on and on and on and on. But I want to introduce you to Donald Watkins. Donald Watkins is been a brilliant attorney, a career as a brilliant attorney, and he kind of retired a little bit from that not too long ago. But he recently, last year, signed an exclusive contract with the government of Namibia to mine uranium for sale to nuclear power stations worldwide. And then later that summer, the Namibian Energy Company was awarded a petroleum exploration license by the Namibian Ministry of Mines and Energy. Lately, this past fall, Donald Watkins brilliantly guided Alabama State University and Total Protection Services Global to create a Nuclear Protection Academy. And it got a letter of support from a lot of people, including the chairman and president and chief executive officer of Southern Nuclear Operating Company. This is a fascinating thing for us here. We want to know more about it, and so Donald Watkins has agreed to join us. Welcome to the program, Donald.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on to talk about all of it. Thank you.
All right. Well, let's talk about it. How did you? I mean, let's begin with Alabama State University. How did you manage to guide them to create the Nuclear Protection Academy with the Total Protection Services?
Well, I had known Francina Jarez, who is the CEO and founder of Total Protection Services. She's in the nuclear security business, has mm-hmm. been there for 12 years. I was always impressed with her. I didn't know any blacks in that business when I met her 12 years ago.
Yeah.
And we reunited this past summer, and she told me about her brainchild. And it was to start a first-of-its-kind academy to train the people on a college campus on the high-impact, high-threat security protection services so that it would be a feeder to the industry. There are 64 nuclear power generation facilities in the United States, and that this would be a feeder to all of those 64 facilities. And she needed an academic home. Well, I was familiar with Alabama State. My father used to be president of Alabama State from 1962 to 1981.
Oh, really?
And I grew up on that college campus.
Okay.
And I used to be a trustee on that school's board of trustees for 8 years. And I've always kept my relationship there. And I thought the two would be a perfect fit. Alabama State is one of the few historically black colleges and universities that has level 6 accreditation, which is the highest you can get from the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools. And an 8-credit rated, unqualified audits for a string of years. And so, objectively speaking, it had all of the criteria that matters to corporate America and in terms of management, financial systems of controls. And TPSG is an industry leader. So it was a marriage between two equally yoked partners. And so we presented the matter to the Alabama State University Board of Trustees back in September.
Mm-hmm.
They unanimously approved the teaming arrangement between Total Protection Services and the university. And so the idea has been launched. They are actively working to solicit grant funding both from the private sector and from the public sector, and hope to start the first classes in September of 2014. So it's a wonderful project, first of its kind in America, and it's kind of it's different. It's not what you think of when you think of protecting more than $200 billion in assets at 64 nuclear power generation facilities, and that the main pipeline for protection of those high-value assets mm-hmm. will be people trained at a historically black university in America.
Wow, that is just absolutely fascinating, and extremely exciting to see this happening in a place like I think that's in Montgomery. Isn't that where the university is located?
Yes, it's in Montgomery. You know, it used to be the cradle of the Confederacy, and then it was the birthplace of the modern civil rights movement, and now it's the birthplace of the new wave of business protection for high-value assets in the United States, and is being done on a college that was started for Negroes. That was the official name of the school, Alabama State College for Negroes. And so now it is a leader in the industry and a valuable partner to Total Protection Services. So both from the historical standpoint and from the forward-thinking standpoint, we're very proud of the university and very proud of Total Protection Services. There's nothing like this partnership anywhere in the United States.
Well, we should say that where we reached you was at your office in Birmingham. You're in Birmingham, Alabama. I love Birmingham, Alabama. In fact, there's a little fish restaurant right in the center of town I discovered when I was there last time. You're nestled right there in the foothills of the Smoky Mountains, and it's such a beautiful town. But you really grew up in Montgomery, is that right?
Well, up in Montgomery, and my first business cycle, I was actively practicing law, mm-hmm. started out in Montgomery, and then I expanded my law practice into Birmingham in 1985. Richard Arrington was the first black mayor of Birmingham, and so I expanded it to become his special counsel, a position that I held for about 14 years, and then we both left office together. He left office, and I retired from the active practice of law. And so that's how I got to Birmingham. But I'm from Alabama. I've lived in other places, but I'm from Alabama. I grew up on Alabama State University's campus.
Well, you know, you're a little modest, because when you were at that position with the city, you brilliantly defended it against, I think you won almost every single one of the contests that came your direction, didn't you? Was there one you didn't win?
No, Colonel, when you were a pioneer, Richard Arrington was the first black mayor of Birmingham. So and he was not welcomed by the corporate scene in Birmingham. Mm-hmm. And so when you're the first one, everything is challenged, especially your initiatives to be inclusive, your initiative to be progressive. And so he was being checked all the time, and I had a litigation background, and so he sent for me to come to Birmingham. That's how I got to Birmingham. And we had to litigate a lot of stuff. We were very successful in litigation. We, at that time, viewed law and litigation as a vehicle for advancing public policy.
Oh, really? Okay.
And it was the only way we could advance public policy. So
yeah.
For 14 years, that's what I did. And we made a lot of things happen, and we were very, very successful, a great support base. And I enjoyed that part of the contribution to Birmingham's growth.
Well, you were, I think, got your big education in Illinois. Did he have to find you in Illinois to bring you back to Birmingham?
Actually, I went off to college to Southern Illinois University in Carbondale to be an architect. And then I read about the Scottsboro Boys case, and then I said, so much for architecture, I want to be a lawyer.
Oh,
and so I came back to Alabama to go to law school. The NAACP awarded me a desegregation scholarship. That's how I got to the University of Alabama's law school.
Oh, wow.
So I came back, went to law school in Tuscaloosa, and one of the first cases I got out of law school was the last known surviving Scottsboro Boys case.
Mm.
He was a fugitive living under his alias in New York, and he wanted a full and complete pardon from the state of Alabama. Not one of these "we forgive you" pardons, but one based on innocence. And so I was very fortunate to be his lawyer and to work 2.5 years on that to obtain the first ever pardon issued to a death row inmate based on innocence. And he received it on behalf of himself and the 8 other Scottsboro boys who were dead at the time this was awarded in 1976. So it's been an interesting background and career.
Well, I guess it certainly has. Kind of reminds me of another Watkins. We've got a guy here in Dallas who's a prosecuting attorney, and he's liberated a lot of people based on DNA. You probably have heard of him.
I've read about him and his work, and I'm very proud of the work he's doing.
Absolutely.
Law, if used correctly, it's a wonderful background for many things, but one thing is you can advance public policy, which we did in Birmingham with Mayor Arrington. You can correct injustices if you're persistent enough and you have the right focus and determination, which we saw in the Scottsboro Boys case and which we see the prosecutor in Dallas doing. And so it's a wonderful tool when used correctly. And the trouble is so many people use it incorrectly, as a tool of oppression.
Yeah.
I had a great career in it, but ultimately I needed to migrate to business. I thought my best contribution would be in the business arena.
Well, before we get to that, I want to ask you, growing up in Montgomery, I hadn't realized that until I just asked you about this a minute ago. You were right there growing up in the forefront of the civil rights movement. You probably remember Selma. You probably remember a lot of things in Montgomery.
Colonel, yeah. I went to Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. That was King's church. King was my pastor, Sunday school teacher, and BTU instructor. It was long before he was famous. And so Rosa Parks was one of my mama's best friends. So when I came home after playing, these are the people who were in the house, in the living room, dining room, mm-hmm. sitting around the dinner table. So I didn't know at the time the significance that these people would have on the world stage. But I was fortunate enough to be exposed to them very early in life. And and the impact that they, along with our parents and our community and church, had on us has lasted a lifetime, and we are very fortunate. So even though we grew up in the harshest racial environment, I was blessed, and my siblings were blessed, to have interacted with people that other folks just read about and have heard about and they studied. But these were real people to us, and they impacted us in a direct and positive way.
What an exciting thing. I think you were born in 1948, correct me if I'm wrong, but that would make you a child then when you met all these people, and you had no idea how important they were going to be.
Yeah, but you knew they were somebody, not because of the way they projected themselves, but because of the seriousness of purpose they had. Seriousness of purpose, but yet they knew how to relate to young children. And they had you believing that you could achieve and you could do anything. It was, you never saw any doubt in their eyes and in their body language or anything. If you could achieve, you could do anything.
Yeah, you were still, oh gee whiz, you were still a teenager, I think, during the time that the Civil Rights Bill was signed in 1964?
And I was in elementary school, junior high school, and I graduated from high school in 1966, so I was there for all of the civil rights stuff, all of the sit-ins, demonstrations, Selma to Montgomery March, all of it, right there in Montgomery, seen it all. Know all of it. Don't have to read about it. Was part of it.
Wait.
When I came back to practice, you know, my practice was civil rights stuff for a long time.
Oh, really?
Yes. Desegregated the colleges in Alabama. Desegregated the junior colleges. Desegregated so many police departments and fire departments. School systems, housing discrimination, voting discrimination. I mean, the list goes on and on. So there are a lot of landmark cases that that we participated in and led the entire time I was practicing in Montgomery.
Well, you've said that you want to do good, and you wanted to work with a purpose, as these other people around you were doing. Now, you never really intended to go after to make a lot of money, but you did manage to make a lot of money. What were your big breaks there in the business world?
I went to Southern Illinois University, as I mentioned to you earlier. My classmate and roommate was a guy named Darrell Harms. He was out of a little town up in Illinois, but he went to be a chemical engineer. And so we were always tight and close. I knew he was heavier than I was because he was an engineer. You know, it was like a 5-year program with flat rules and all that stuff.
Right, right.
And so, but we stayed in touch. And our first business, when he graduated, I was in law school. Our first business was cable TV. And that was when cable TV was brand new. I was passive. He was active. And we were stringing cable from Jackson, Mississippi, up to Washington, D.C. on the East Coast, from San Diego to Washington State on the West Coast.
Wow.
Ultimately sold that off to what is now Charter Communications with Paul Allen's group. And then we went into cellular communications. We were running cellular towers. And subscriptions from the Missouri land to the California land.
Oh, wow.
Bundled that up and sold that off. But that was, at the time we were running cellular, we had the third largest privately owned cellular company in the United States and UK. And then we left cellular and went into electronic home security and developed that into the largest privately owned home security company in the United States. Sold that to ADT. And then we went into our current business model, which is garbage to fuel, and we do that in 45 countries in South America, Europe, Africa, and Asia. So that's what I do now. But I still use the legal background to help me in my daily work.
I'm fascinated with a garbage to fuel, and there's so many things I want to ask you about, but let's touch on that for just a minute. How did you get into garbage to fuel, and give us an indication how you managed to spread it to what did you say, 45 countries?
Yeah, we had 45. Well, what happened was when we came out of electronic home security, the only model we knew in business was recurring revenues and then minimize recurring expenses. So that's what cable is. Every month people pay cable bills. Every month they pay telephone bills. Every month they pay these electronic, you know, home security bills. And so that's the model we knew. And so we were looking for another business in that cycle, and then we ran across some World War II technology that the Germans had. At the end of World War II, the United States took two things out of Nazi Germany. They took the rocket scientists and their work, and they brought it to America, took it to Huntsville, Alabama, and they developed the rocket program, the whole space program for America.
Yeah.
They brought out of Nazi Germany the synthetic fuel gas, and they took them to a place called Muscle Shoals, took their product, their work product, to Tennessee Valley Authority, and they classified that for 50 years. 1996, they declassified that. And so when they declassified it, our company was the first one up there to get it, and then we basically bought the technology from the Tennessee Valley Authority, bought their pilot facility, bought everything, and then we developed it further, and then we started deploying it in the international markets, because you could get long-term contracts. Some places the contracts are 50 years. They're with national governments with a 49-year renewal period. And so we focused internationally. We went internationally at the beginning in 2007, and we focused exclusively in international places. So rather than dealing with a city council or a county commission, we'll deal with a president of a country or a prime minister or somebody who can make national policy out of their garbage.
Isn't it incredibly difficult, though, dealing internationally? I mean, you've got language barriers, you have law barriers, you have changing governments, you have revolutions and everything. What? How do you do that?
Colonel, what we found is this: all over the world, no matter where you are, people create garbage every day, all day, and the garbage created has to be disposed of somewhere by somebody all day long, and everywhere it's created, some government has to pay somebody to dispose of it. And then our idea was, it's already created, we don't have to look for it, you're already paying somebody to dispose of it, why don't you let us take it, just pay us what you're paying on the disposal fee, and let us convert it to fuel, and let us give you the first option to buy the fuel. So what appears on the surface to be a problem for you is really one of your greatest assets. So you don't have to go look for it, it's already there, and all you do is convert what you think is a problem into an asset and a natural resource. You use it and you disperse it right there in your own country. So it's an easy concept for people to understand. It's a technology that's been around since World War II. And the Germans were running in 1943, 44, and 45, the Germans were running their war machine off of garbage to ethanol.
Wow. That's really, really, really something, and I had no idea about that. So, well, good. You've taken the technology, something we captured with the war, and you've turned it into something that is benefiting the world worldwide. Now, tell me about what you're doing in Namibia. Our mutual friend Francina tells me that you own all the uranium in the world. I think that's probably not quite true, but
we went to Namibia back in 2011. And what was going on? I was already working in Africa on the waste to energy, you know, businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I got to Namibia, which is a mineral rich, natural resources rich country, and it's right to the west of South Africa, so it's on the water. It's a small country, but well developed. There used to be a German colony, so it's well developed. And everybody there speaks English, so it's easy, it's comfortable to get around. Mm-hmm. And most people would know it because it's where Angelina Jolie went and adopted one of her children. So that's what most people know Namibia for. But anyway, we formed a company, me and a couple of guys formed a company, and we applied for uranium concessions in joint venture with the national government, licenses in conjunction with the Namibian government. So what we have done is partnered with the national government in two zones, uranium production and oil production. And it was a way of...
So many fascinating things we learn here on the Science News Radio Network. We're going to take a break in a couple of minutes and then come back in the second half hour. So don't forget to download the second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow. We appreciate your being with us. I'm your host, I'm Colonel Mason. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind
Whom in the den of strangers will we meet today?
Rachmaninoff. There is enough great music for a lifetime, but not enough lifetime for great music.